Class is back in session. It's time for Baptist Basics University from BaptistBasics.org.
Welcome back to Baptist Basics University. I am Matthew Gage, and this is lesson number 5 in our series going through the book of Daniel. And we will be in chapter 4 today as we look at the humbling of Nebuchadnezzar. Now, Daniel chapter 4 is, to me, the strangest chapter in the Bible. Perhaps one of the strangest in the Bible. It is the story about how God gets the attention of a pagan king and, at the height of his power, humbles him. And brings him from being one of the greatest, most celebrated, most successful people in the sight of men, to being about as low as a person can get. And throughout this all, there is a message, and I think there's lessons for us to learn in this. But it just is such a strange story. In fact, in the book of Daniel, this really stands out because it's not written like the rest. It's actually written pretty much by Nebuchadnezzar himself as part of a proclamation or of some sort that he's giving out. So it's a very, 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 very strange story. As far as historical background, there's not a lot of evidence for this, kind of like with most of the book of Daniel. But I believe it happened, and we'll get into a little bit later on. There actually could be some scientific, psychological basis for what Nebuchadnezzar goes through. So anyway, we're going to get into this very, very strange chapter here. So Daniel chapter 4 and verse number 1. Nebuchadnezzar, the king, unto all people, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, peace be multiplied unto you. So he begins, there's going to be a whole lot of as he's writing this, as he's telling this story. So here we have preserved in this chapter, basically like a proclamation by Nebuchadnezzar, and he starts out by just addressing people, nations, and languages. I think I talked about that before, that the nations would be like people groups and the languages, you know. So, I mean, basically, you know, this is saying, everybody, listen up. And the peace be multiplied unto you. Actually, you know, it's kind of interesting. We see variations of that, even like Paul even using variations of a greeting like that. It's just very common in the kind of the Middle East area for a greeting along those lines. Verse number 2. I thought it good to show the signs and wonders that the high God hath wrought toward me. Verse 3. How great are his signs and how mighty are his wonders. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and his dominion is from generation to generation. So immediately you're thinking, wait a minute, who in the world is writing this? You know, this does not sound like Nebuchadnezzar. We've already seen, so, and we'll take some time probably at the end to kind of look at a progression of Nebuchadnezzar, of his concept of God. But in this case, you know, you think, wow, I mean, it seems like, you know, this would come out straight out of the book of Psalms or something, especially there, verse 3. But, I mean, he's talking about how powerful God is and what he's doing and how God's in control and God's kingdom and lasts from generation to generation, you know, forever. So, I mean, you think, well, who is this? You know, this sounds like this shouldn't be a pagan king. Well, this is because the first 3 verses are written after the story. This is after Nebuchadnezzar has learned his lesson. And so that's why those are kind of written that way. And I like it in verse 2. You know, he says, I thought it good to show you the signs and wonders that the high God hath wrought toward me. He's like, I think it's good that you understand what has happened. I think you should understand the lessons I've had to learn. Um, you know, experience is the best teacher. Most experience is bad experience, though. But you can always learn from someone else's experience. So if someone else goes through something and I can learn from it, that saves me from having to go through the same deal. You know, if I saw my sister get in trouble for doing something, you know, I made a little mental note that said, don't do that or I will get in trouble. You know, and I'm sure she, you know, did the same thing with me. I learned through their experience. Well, this is a case where Nebuchadnezzar is sharing his experience so that others could benefit from it, or even just to explain what has happened in a sense with him. Verse number 4 begins the story. I, Nebuchadnezzar, was at rest in mine house and flourishing in my palace. Now, the setting for this, Nebuchadnezzar is in Babylon. He's in his palace, which archaeologists and historians say must have just been magnificent. It was a huge palace, among the many wondrous buildings and projects that Nebuchadnezzar had undertaken there in Babylon, rebuilding it. We've talked about what a builder he was. But this palace evidently was something. So as he is in this palace, you know, the height of the power of one of the greatest kingdoms that the world has ever seen, Nebuchadnezzar is sitting back in his palace. You know, so think about how high and exalted this man is. Verse 5, I saw a dream which made me afraid, and the thoughts upon my bed and the visions of my head troubled me. I like the rhythm of those words again. So Nebuchadnezzar is there, once again has a dream. We've kind of been through this before, Nebuchadnezzar having dreams. Well, here we go again. Verse 6, therefore made I a decree to bring in all the wise men of Babylon before me, that they might make known unto me the interpretation of the dream. So here we go. You know, king's had a dream. It's troubling him. Let's call in everybody and get an answer. Verse 7, then came in the magicians, the astrologers, the Chaldeans, and the soothsayers, and I told the dream before them, but they did not make known unto me the interpretation thereof. So like in chapter 2, where Nebuchadnezzar had the dream of the statue, it's kind of very similar in the setup, except this time Nebuchadnezzar actually did remember the dream, and he told it to him, and no one could give him the interpretation of it. Verse 8, but at the last, Daniel was in before me, whose name was Belteshazzar. That's the pagan name that he was given, if you'll remember from chapter 1. According to the name of my God, and in whom is the spirit of the holy gods, and before him I told the dream, saying, so here we go, Daniel's finally called. I think it's interesting, it says at the last. Why did they wait till the very end to call Daniel? We've already seen Daniel has experience at this in interpreting dreams. Why didn't they call for him first? Partly, I think Nebuchadnezzar knew it wasn't good news, and maybe he just didn't want to know it. Or maybe, you know, just like we are, a lot of times we know what the answer is, and we're just not willing to go through with it. Whether that is, you know, we look down and say, boy, I feel terrible, it's because I need to lose weight. But the last thing you want to do is go to the gym or go on a diet, or, you know, something's going wrong in your life. And you know, deep down what you really need is to get back closer to God, is to get back in church, is, you know, to pray more, to study more, but it's the last thing in the world that you really want to do, you know? So I think we see that human tendency in there is that, you know, he deep down, I think he knew Daniel would probably shoot straight with him and tell him what was going on. But I think he really wanted someone to tell him everything's going to be okay, because I think he knew this dream was a bad sign for him. So verse 9, O Belteshazzar, master of the magicians, because I know that the spirit of the holy gods is in thee, and no secret troubleth thee, tell me the visions of my dream that I have seen, and the interpretation thereof. So he addresses them, first of all, addressing Daniel there. Master of the magicians, I want to point out that this isn't saying that Daniel is a magician practicing the black arts, anything like that. This is basically saying, you know, that he is master, that is over. Part of Daniel's position probably that was he was over the educated people of the kingdom, and that mixture of with education, science, and religion. probably, I wouldn't think, I'd think less of magician, you know, you think sorcery or black magic, something along those lines. I think it probably is safer to say in that case to think of the word magi, like the wise men that came to see Christ, would probably be a little bit closer in definition there to that. But when he's saying that, he's not saying Daniel's involved in something that we would frown upon or the Jews would frown upon. It's just kind of denoting who he is and his position. And you see Daniel's reputation, you know, that that the secret won't trouble him and that he knows these secrets and that there's something special, you know, God-given supernatural ability that Daniel has. And he addresses all that. So, you know, like I say, why didn't they call him first? But they didn't. Verse 10. Thus were the visions of mine head in my bed. I saw and behold a great tree in the midst of the earth, and the height thereof was great. Now, I'm going to give you my idea and try to paint a picture of how I think this looked. Imagine, if you will, a great plain, something, you know, a savanna in Africa, you know, even a desert. I mean, just imagine a great flat expanse. And in the middle of this grassland or maybe desert type area, there is a giant tree. Along the lines of like the giant redwood trees in California and Oregon, just think of it, just a gigantic tree. Verse 11, the tree grew and was strong, and the height thereof reached unto heaven, and the sight thereof to the end of all the earth. So in this plain, this tree just keeps growing and becoming taller to where it is just at a fantastic height, where it just seems like, you know, it's touching the clouds off of this plane and just dominating the area so that it can be seen for miles and miles and miles around. Just huge, gigantic tree. Verse 12, the leaves thereof were fair, and the fruit thereof much, and in it was meat for all. The beast of the field had shadow under it, and the fowls of the heaven dwelt in the boughs thereof, and all flesh was fed of it. So this tree kind of has its own, it's bountiful, it's flourishing, it's kind of got its own ecosystem going as it's nourishing these animals that underneath it, you know, you have bear and deer and other types of like forest animals. I that's the way I picture it. Living underneath it, and they're living under the shadow of this tree and feeding off of it, feeding off the fruit and feeding off the, you know, the leaves, and just part of this ecosystem of this tree. And that and of course the fowls of the heaven, the birds are dwelling in it and eating of this tree, and just seems like, you know, every life form is somehow connected to this tree. They're feeding off of it. They're living in it. They're protected by it, but just everyone has something to do with this tree in their life cycle. Verse 13, I saw in the visions of my head upon my bed, and behold, a watcher and an holy one came down from heaven. Now that watcher and an holy one, that's talking about, it's not two different entities. That's one. Imagine an angel. That's the best definition without getting very technical into, you know, ancient Babylonian beliefs and stuff. But pretty much I think what he sees in this vision is an angel, and that's a pretty safe assumption. So this angel now appears and gives this message in verse 14. He cried aloud and said thus, hew down the tree and cut off his branches, shake off his leaves and scatter his fruit. Let the beasts get away from under it, and the fowls from his branches. So this angel appears and said, you know, fellas, get the chainsaw, get the axe, get the saw. We're cutting down this tree. And we're not just going to cut it down. We're going to chop all the branches off. We're going to scatter the leaves and the fruit and basically destroy this tree and, you know, even to scatter the livelihood and that ecosystem that's built up around it. You know, just to demolish the tree. Verse 15. Nevertheless, let me point out too, go back to verse 14. Notice all of a sudden it starts talking, it personifies this tree all of a sudden, and cut off his branches, shake off his, it didn't say its branches, its leaves, its fruit. It says his leaves, his fruit, his branches. So this is our first clue of what this vision is about. And I think this is what Nebuchadnezzar suspects, is that tree represents somebody and probably him. Verse 15. Nevertheless, leave the stump of his roots in the earth, even with a band of iron and brass in the tender grass of the field, and let it be wet with the dew of heaven, and let the portion be, and let his portion be with the beasts in the grass of the earth. But instead of completely killing and annihilating this tree and you know, leaving no remembrance of it, leaving no hope for it to come back, they chop the tree off, but they leave the stump. They leave the roots. Now, I'm not a big outdoorsman, but I've been around and helped my dad, you know, cut firewood and stuff. And I know, you know, you leave that stump there, it's a nuisance, it's a pain. You know, if you're clearing out a field, you're going to try to grind that stump up or burn it, but you're going to do your best, you know, to get rid of that. You know, especially if you're trying to turn that into farmland or something, or clean it up, you know, for grazing or something. And there are trees that if you leave the roots in the ground, like a lot of other plants, you know, they'll begin to sprout back up. They'll sprout new branches, and you know, you don't kill the tree. There still is a chance for it to live and to start growing again and start flourishing again. So that's what's they're doing this. They're leaving that stump of this great tree there. So we know it's not being killed, whatever this is being represented, but there's some vestige of it left. And the band of iron and brass, that I kind of had some trouble looking up and trying to figure that out. They're not really sure. It's not that thing would, you know, there's any benefit to putting like a some type of iron or brass, you know, cover or anything on that. It'd probably actually help it rot more. But this is really a sign of just like being chained up and being of judgment. That's more that has less to do. It's more symbolic than practical and tied to this vision. That's really a sign of judgment. Okay, so verse 16, let his heart be changed. So another instance right here, it's going to be talking about a heart. Well, does a tree have a heart? Well, unless you're an ooey gooey metaphysical hippie, you know, tree hugger person, then, you know, you probably don't believe that trees have hearts or spirits or anything. So right here, this is another case where we know this vision is deeper than a tree. This is talking about a man. Verse 16 says, let his heart be changed from man's, and let a beast's heart be given unto him, and let seven times pass over him. So this command goes out, you know, that this man or whoever this represents is still alive, but is not even really human for this seven times. Now, what the seven times represents, we don't know. It just says seven times, 7 days, 7 months, 7 years, seven of something. It's not clear there. So verse 17, continuing the angel's message. This matter is by the decree of the watchers and the demand by the word of the holy ones, to the intent that the living may know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men and giveth it to whomsoever he will, and setteth up over it the basest of men. So right here in verse 17, it's kind of interesting. We actually see the purpose for all this given by the angel in this vision. It says, well, why is this going on? It's so people will realize who's really in charge. Is it man? No, it is God, that God is sovereign, that God is active in the affairs of man. This is a message throughout the book of Daniel, that God is in control, that God raises up the kings that he wills. And you know, is it because of the greatness of man? No, mankind compared to God is nothing. Like it says, setteth up over the basest, the most common, the lowest of men. So, you know, it didn't say, well, God picked you because you were somebody special. No, God just picked you to rule, because you're the one he wanted to rule, for whatever reason. It's not because you're so awesome that, you know, it's kind of a smack at, a little slap at, royalty and some of the egos that go even into modern political systems there. So there we go. That's the vision of this tree, this dream that Nebuchadnezzar had, this tree that grows and all the life around it. An angel appears and says, cut down the tree and destroy it, but leave the stump. And that through all of this, the message of this and the lesson that will be learned is that God is in control, that God is sovereign, that God is powerful. So verse 18, continuing. This dream I, King Nebuchadnezzar, have seen. Now thou, O Belteshazzar, talking to Daniel, remember, declare the interpretation thereof. For as much as all the wise men of my kingdom are not able to make known unto me the interpretation, but thou art able, for the spirit of the holy gods is in thee. So the king finally, after he tells it, you know, he gives this charge to Daniel. It says, Daniel, you know, no one else can tell me. It's up to you. Daniel, please tell me what this vision is. And I say, I think Nebuchadnezzar was troubled because he knew this probably applied to him. And I don't know how you interpret that dream for good. It seems like a very negative dream. I mean, it's not like they praised or worshiped the tree. I mean, they chopped it down. They killed it. Talk about giving it the heart of a beast. And, you know, this doesn't seem like a very positive dream to be having. Or a positive vision to see. So, of course, Nebuchadnezzar is troubled. So here we go. In verse 19, we see Daniel's reaction. Then Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, was astonished for 1 hour, and his thoughts troubled him. Because, obviously, he's soaking in this the meaning of this vision. And I think Daniel knew pretty much right away this was bad. And you're about to have to tell the person this is aimed at, you know, that something bad's about to happen to him. For 1 hour, there are people that skeptics, or not really skeptics, but people on the Bible kind of get a little critical with their analysis, and they'll say, well, you know, he couldn't have sat there for 1 hour and not said anything. But regardless, he's there for a good length of time, just so moved and so taken by this vision that he's almost in a trance-like state. He's speechless at the kind of the horror of the interpretation of this message. Continuing verse 19, the king spake and said, Belteshazzar, let not the dream or the interpretation thereof trouble thee. Belteshazzar answered and said, my lord, the dream be to them that hate thee, and the interpretation thereof to thine enemies. So Belteshazzar has to kind of snap him out and say, Daniel, it's okay to tell me. In fact, I kind of wonder after reading this if maybe it wasn't such a supernatural thing. Daniel just knew it was bad and did not want to tell Nebuchadnezzar because of how horrible it was. Nebuchadnezzar kind of has to pat him on the back and say, look, buddy, it's okay. You can tell me. I know this isn't good, but you can tell me. And Daniel immediately says, look, this is for thine enemies. You know, that this is this message, who's going to be excited about this? The people that hate you, you know. So this was good news for everyone who's not a fan of Nebuchadnezzar. That's basically what he says there at the end of verse 19. So verse 20, the tree that thou sawest, which grew and was strong, whose height reached unto the heaven and the sight thereof to all the earth, whose leaves were fair, verse 21, and fruit thereof much, and in it was meat for all, meat there being food, under which the beasts of the field dwelt, and upon whose branches the fowls of the heaven had their habitation. So he rehashes, you know, you saw this dream about this great and mighty tree and all the, you know, everything about it. So verse 22, here we go, here's the interpretation. It is thou, O king, that art grown and become strong, for thy greatness is grown and reacheth unto heaven, and thy dominion to the end of the earth. So he says, you know, Daniel points to him and says, look, buddy, you are the tree that's represented. You, your kingdom. You know, Nebuchadnezzar is reigning over one of the greatest empires, over one of the greatest expanses of earth, especially for that time period. He's got so much power, so much riches, so much glory, so much honor. And that's what's being represented by that great tree. That great tree represents Nebuchadnezzar and his kingdom. So verse 23. And whereas the king saw a watcher and an holy one come down from heaven and saying, hew the tree down and destroy it, yet leave the stump of the roots thereof in the earth, even with a band of iron and brass in the tender grass of the field, and let it be wet with the dew of heaven, and let his portion be with the beast of the field till seven times pass over him. So he's rehashing the dream, saying, okay, you remember they said they're going to chop it down and everything. So verse 24, this is the interpretation, O king, and this is the decree of the Most High, which has come upon my lord the king. So here we go. He says, Daniel says, look, this message is from God himself, and this is for you. Verse 25, that they shall drive thee from men, and thy dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field, and they shall make thee to eat grass as oxen, and they shall wet thee with the dew of heaven, and seven times shall pass over thee, till thou know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will. So he says, king, you're the one this is about. You're the one that will be driven out from men to live as a wild beast, to no longer eat the banquets and the feasts, but to eat grass just like a wild animal, a cow or an ox. That wet with the dew of heaven. I take that to being that he's going to be living out in the wild, no shelter, just basically a animal in human form almost. And that this would last for that seven times. And like I said, what is that? We don't know. 7 days, 7 months, 7 years, but a lengthy period of time. I'd lean closer to probably like 7 months or 7 years. Probably 7 months. If I had to guess, I'd say 7 months, but that's just me. But at the end of that, we see that, you know, it says until thou know. So this is like, you're going through all this till you learn this lesson. You know, it's one of those things. I was talking about the experience, learning through experience. Sometimes, you know, we have to go through a lot before we finally learn a lesson. God has to keep, you know, testing us and testing us and testing us and putting us through trials till we finally, you know, gain the patience we're supposed to have or gain the faith that we're supposed to have until we're strengthened to the point that God wants us to. In this case, you know, it takes Nebuchadnezzar this seven times, whatever that is. It takes him that long of living like a wild beast to finally learn those lessons that God needs him to learn. Verse 26, and whereas they commanded to leave the stump of the tree roots, thy kingdom shall be sure unto thee after that thou shalt have known that the heavens do rule. So he says, okay, king, at the end of this, because the stump was left and the roots was left, you know, you're not dying. Once you've learned this lesson, once you've kind of come back in from living like an animal, then you're going to return to your kingdom. You're going to return to your power once you've learned the lesson that God is in control. Verse 27, wherefore, O king, let my counsel be acceptable unto thee, and break off thy sins by righteousness, and thine iniquities by showing mercy to the poor, if it may be a lengthening of thy tranquility. So Daniel throws in his little two cents here, and says, okay, king, if you want my advice, you know, God's judgment is coming. It's time to repent. It's time to turn around. It's time to go the other way. And, you know, that's what that's talking about. Break off thy sins by righteousness and thy iniquities by showing mercy to the poor. He's saying, look, turn around, go the other way, and stave off this judgment that is coming from God. So there we go. That is the recording of the dream, of the interpretation of it. And you can imagine, you know, how did Nebuchadnezzar take that? There's this prophecy, this dream he has. He trusts Daniel to interpret it correctly. We've already seen Daniel has interpreted correctly before. And probably in many more matters than are recorded in this Bible, Nebuchadnezzar has had to lean on Daniel's counsel and found him trustworthy. So after all of this, does Nebuchadnezzar change his ways? What happens? Well, we find out what happens beginning in verse 28. All this came upon the king, Nebuchadnezzar. So all of that comes true. What was prophesied about him going mad, living as an animal, all that comes true. verse 29. At the end of 12 months, he walked in the palace of the kingdom of Babylon. So a year later, he is in his palace. Remember, this palace must have been magnificent. It must have been huge. And he is, he could look out over the city that he built. He was the architect of it. He organized and financed the building of so much that stood around him, of temples, of perhaps even the Hanging Gardens, you know, one of the seven wonders of the world, of walls, of gates, of palaces. He could look all around, and this one man was responsible for all of it. And his heart was lifted up with pride, we see in verse 30. The king spake and said, "Is not this great Babylon that I have built for the house of the kingdom and by the might of my power and for the honor of my majesty?" So Nebuchadnezzar gets a little bit of an I problem. He thinks, "I did this. I am special. I am somebody." And if any man upon the face of the earth really had a reason to believe that, it probably was Nebuchadnezzar standing there looking over that city. But we know, and I've got down as a cross reference there in my Bible, Proverbs in chapter 16. Let me flip over there so I don't quote it wrong. Proverbs chapter 16, verse 18. This said, "Pride goeth before destruction, and an haughty spirit before fall." Well, he's got his pride. He's got his haughty spirit. Here comes the fall. Verse 31. While the word was in the king's mouth, there fell a voice from heaven saying, "O King Nebuchadnezzar, to thee it is spoken, the kingdom is departed from thee." Verse 32. "And they shall drive thee from men, and thy dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field. And they shall make thee to eat grass as oxen, and seven times shall pass over thee until thou know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men and giveth it to whomsoever he will." So judgment comes. Nebuchadnezzar has crossed the line. God's been patient. God has given him some time to repent. It's too late. He's crossed the line, reached the point of no return. And, you know, God says, "That's enough, big boy. You should have listened to me. It's been spoken. It's been, you know, you've seen the vision of what's coming. You didn't learn. So all that glory, all that honor, all that magnificent kingdom he has taken away from him." And his heart turned to that like a beast. He goes mad, basically. Verse 33. "The same hour was the thing fulfilled upon Nebuchadnezzar, and he was driven from men and did eat grass as oxen, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven till his hair were grown like eagle's feathers and his nails like bird's claws." So the mighty king is now living as a madman, as an animal. You know, he's not even living in a house. He's living in the wild, living in the fields. He's not eating the banquets and the feast. He's eating grass as if he was a cow or an ox. His body wet with the dew of heaven, that, you know, he's sleeping outside under the stars every night, just sleeping in the grass, waking up and being soaked with the dew. His hair grown like eagle's feathers, that just hair is long, unkept, and probably living in those conditions is going to stimulate some hair growth even over the whole body, and just unkept hair basically is what that is. And his nails like bird's claws, just absolutely not taking care of himself. His fingernails have grown long and hard from the life and from the elements, and that this man who was once the mightiest king upon the face of the earth is now nothing more, it seems, than an animal in a human body. And so, I mean, what really happened to Nebuchadnezzar? Let's talk about it a little bit. Now, there's some theories about what kind of happened with him. It would appear, one of the things I read is said that probably he was protected during this time of this insanity that he kind of goes through. And that's, I'm calling it insanity. Some people say, well, you're undermining the word of God. This was something. No, I think, you know, God can use practical things to accomplish his will at times. And what he's going through here has a psychological basis. That's why I'm calling this madness or insanity that he enters into here. But some of the sources say, you know, he probably was protected. He probably was hidden away. His advisors, his council, his co-rulers kept the kingdom going while he was a madman. And maybe they kept him locked away in gardens and in the palaces, or had him hidden away. But probably was not just turned loose to run wild. They probably did protect him for this time period that of his madness. Now, what is this? There is a couple of psychological things this could be, and I've seen some other theories on it, but let me give you this one. There is something called clinical lycanthropy. Now, lycanthropy can mean a couple of different things, but basically means a man turning into a wolf, technically speaking. In this case, it's kind of a broad term used for a man turning into an animal, or believing they've turned into an animal. That's where the clinical steps in. That this isn't, you can actually get into the black magic kind of stuff and the new age stuff, lycanthropy. People actually think they turn into animals and stuff, and freaky stuff, you know, werewolf kind of things. But clinical lycanthropy basically is that people think they are. Wikipedia gave this definition: a rare psychiatric disorder that involves a delusion that the affected person can transform into, or has transformed into, or is a non-human animal. So basically, this insanity is such that a person believes they're an animal, that they act like an animal. A couple other terms you may see: boanthropy, I'm not sure exactly how you say it, but that basically means you think you're a cow, you believe you're a cow, or zoanthropy, which is basically means you're an animal. But the usual kind of common term is clinical lycanthropy. And this is very, very rare that someone would face this. I have this account, John Wolford. I've been using some of his writings pretty heavily going through the book of Daniel. He gave this, and quoted this from a man named Raymond Harrison in a book called Introduction to the Old Testament. And he gives this account. This is Raymond Harrison speaking here, writing: a great many doctors spend an entire busy professional career without once encountering an instance of the kind of monomania, that's insanity, described in the book of Daniel. The present writer, therefore, considers himself particularly fortunate to have actually observed a clinical case of boanthropy in a British mental institution in 1946. So this isn't that long ago, 1946. The patient was in his early 20s, who reportedly had been hospitalized for about 5 years. His symptoms were well-developed on admission, and diagnosis was immediate and conclusive. He was of average height and weight, with good physique, and was in excellent bodily health. His mental symptoms included pronounced antisocial tendencies, and because of this, he spent the entire day from dawn till dusk outdoors in the grounds of the institution. His daily routine consisted of wandering around the magnificent lawns with which the otherwise dingy hospital situation was graced, and it was his custom to pluck up and eat handfuls of grass as he went along. On observation, he was seen to discriminate carefully between grass and weeds, and on inquiry from the attendant, the writer was told the diet of this patient consisted exclusively of grass from the hospital lawns. He never ate institutional food with the other inmates, and his only drink was water. The writer was able to examine him cursorily, and the only physical abnormality noted consisted of a lengthening of the hair and a coarse, thickened condition of the fingernails. Without institutional care, this patient would have manifested precisely the same physical conditions as those mentioned in Daniel chapter 4, verse 33. From the foregoing, it seems evident that the author of the fourth chapter of Daniel was describing accurately an attestable, if rather rare, mental affliction. So there you go. The testimony of someone who had a background in medicine, it seems, and was able to observe and and even kind of check out a little bit a man with this type of insanity that seems to be the same as Nebuchadnezzar experiences here in verse 33. So just want to throw that out there to you. Now, you can believe it or not. You can say, well, it's supernatural. God made them, you know, act like an ox, and there's no psychology to it, whatever. Well, whatever. I'm just going to throw that out to you because I think God uses practical things sometimes. And in this case, I think God struck him down with this particular form of insanity. So verse number 34. And at the end of the days, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted up mine eyes unto heaven, and mine understanding returned unto me, and I blessed the Most High, and I praised and honored him that liveth forever, whose dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom is from generation to generation. So Nebuchadnezzar, who once lived in the palace, who's been living as an animal, now finally gains his sanity back. And what's the first thing that he does? He's learned his lesson. He praises God, and he talks about that God is in control, whose dominion, that's his kingdom, his control is an everlasting dominion, that it goes forever and ever. The kingdom is from generation to generation, that this lasts forever. Verse 35. And all the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing, and he doeth according to his will in the army of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth, and none can stay his hand or say unto him, what doest thou? So basically, he's saying the mightiness of God, that comparatively, all us humans, all the people on earth are nothing compared to him, and that no one can stop him, that God will do as he wills. And that no one can question him. No one has that kind of right or authority or power to stop him or even question him. So verse 36, and at the same time, my reason returned unto me, and for the glory of my kingdom, mine honor and brightness returned unto me, and my counselors and my lords sought unto me, and I was established in my kingdom, and excellent majesty was added unto me. So not only does his reason return to him, his authority, his kingdom has returned to him. And once again, Nebuchadnezzar sits upon the throne of Babylon as he did before. Well, not quite as he did before, because he's learned some hard lessons. He's ate a good dose of humble pie and taken those lessons that he's not in control. He didn't build all that, that God is in control. God allowed him to do it, that Nebuchadnezzar wasn't the ultimate authority. God was. So verse 37, now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, all whose works are truth and his ways judgment, and those that walk in pride he is able to abase. Well, that's a pretty harsh warning there, coming from a man who had to learn that the hard way. Those that walk in pride he is able to abase. You know, he can humble us. That's, you know, when it, one of the things in Proverbs, it says, you know, these six things does the Lord hate, yea, seven are abomination to him, is a proud look. God despises pride, and praises humility. So, let's see. Okay. Well, let's go ahead. Let me wrap this up, this chapter up, by looking at, I've got some little quotes here. Nebuchadnezzar's spiritual progression. We don't want to look at this because after chapter 4, he's done with the historical portion of Scripture. But we can see in these four chapters kind of a little bit of a progression up until where he's at there at the end of chapter 4. In chapter 1, verses 19 through 20, we see him appreciating, you know, God's servants, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, otherwise known as Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, and Daniel. You know, he appreciates them and appreciates God's blessings on them. In chapter 2, verse 47, he talks about how God is a God of gods. Among gods, he's among gods. He's a Lord of kings. That he rules over kings. This deity that Daniel serves is has power, has authority. Also, revealer of secrets. That's kind of a common thing there, that they seem to, in the polytheistic mind, that you know, they would attribute different ideas or different areas of earth and religion, you know, to specific gods. Well, it seems like what Nebuchadnezzar tries to do with the God of heaven, our God, is to say that he is, yes, he is among the pantheon of gods, and that one of his specialties is revealing secrets and interpreting dreams and such. Chapter 3, verse 25, he sees the Son of God in the furnace. He looks down in there and realizes whoever that fourth person was in there had a relation. And we talked a little bit about that. Chapter 3, verse 28, he blesses the God who delivered them out of the furnace. So he's even honoring this God. In chapter 3, verse 29, he acknowledges the power of God, that God was able to protect the men in the furnace. In chapter 4, verses 2 and 3, he calls God a high God, exalted, above other gods. He acknowledges God's greatness and sovereignty. We talked quite a bit about that in verse 3. And then here at the end, verses 34 and 35, he calls him most high again, elevating him to a supreme position. He acknowledges God's greatness and his power and his sovereignty over men. And then in verse 37, he calls him the King of Heaven, that God is ruling over everything, that God is in control of everything. And in the heaven sense, even in a Babylonian mind, it would seem like, from what little bit I've read, that basically they're saying that this God, he's saying that God is over gods, that heaven would be a place for the kind of the spirit world, and that God was supreme over them. It doesn't say they don't exist, but he's supreme over them. So that kind of leads you to this kind of sticky little debate situation. That is, with this progression, and you can really see this progression of Nebuchadnezzar kind of learning and respecting God more through these first four chapters of Daniel. But is it enough for him to be saved? And that's one of the age-old questions of people in the Bible. Well, do you think Judas was saved? Do you think Saul was saved? Do you think Nebuchadnezzar was saved? Personally, I really don't think that he was, based on this evidence here. I can see him having a healthy respect for God, but it just seems to me that there's enough little evidence in there that he is still holding on to some of the polytheistic stuff that he was in his background. Now, he definitely has learned to respect God and learn about God, but I don't think it's enough to garner a personal salvation for him. That's my opinion. That's my judgment. And you can disagree. And even going back through this now, I've made my mind thinking, well, hey, that does sound pretty good. But I'm not comfortable enough to base my opinion. Now, I hope I'm wrong. I hope we get to heaven and Nebuchadnezzar is there. I don't want anybody to go to hell. But just based on the evidence here, I think Nebuchadnezzar gained a healthy respect for God, but I don't think he had the faith to say, this one God, I put my faith and trust in him. I think he put faith in a God that was greater than his other gods he also had faith in, but I don't think he ever loved God and served God exclusively, which, throughout the Bible, the message is, thou shalt serve no other gods before me. Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thine heart, all thy soul, all thy might. The message of the Bible is one God and serving him only. And I don't think Nebuchadnezzar got to that point, at least by the testimony of the scriptures here. So, but it is an interesting study. And the thing I would take from that is that, you can respect God. You can learn about God. And you can love God's word, even study the Bible, but you know what? Is that enough to be saved? No, it's not. It takes a personal faith. It takes it takes us putting our faith and trust in Him, in His finished work, with nothing else added to it, without good works, without baptism. You can love God, you can respect God, but that does not equal salvation. There's a lot of what I would call cults, or you could just say different little branches of Christianity, you know, that I don't believe teach the full gospel. Now, I do think they have a healthy respect for their concept of God, but just because they have morals, just because they do seem to respect God and Christ, does that mean that they're saved? Now, no. You know, even Christ himself said, now, not all of them need to say, Lord, Lord, you know, shall enter in. I think the part of the message here with Nebuchadnezzar is just along those lines. Just because someone says the name of Christ, just because they seem to honor Christ, just because they seem to even put Christ and God in a preeminent place, that does not mean that they're saved according to the teachings of the scripture. That, you know, people can serve God out of the flesh, and they can have a version of truth, but still hold on to the falsehood of other religions. You know, the Catholic Church was really bad about this when they were going out and trying to evangelize, you know, some of these pagan groups, especially like in Mexico and in South America, that they would create this hybrid form of Catholicism where it kind of taking some of the pagan beliefs and mixing them in with the Catholicism and really creating very weird things. And, you know, to where the truth, whatever truth there was in it, not a lot, but it was lost behind all those pagan rituals that they kept. So anyway, that's my judgment, my opinion on that. You can disagree with me if you want. And I've rambled about that long, long past what I said I would. But anyway, though, the main focus of this chapter is just to remember the same lesson that Nebuchadnezzar did. You know, who is in control? It's God. You know, does God pick us because we're somebody special? No, it's not. That God is in control. God chooses who he will. God empowers who he will. That God is sovereign, and kind of to know our place and not be lifted up with pride. If anything, this chapter is a long illustration against being lifted up in pride. So there we go, Daniel chapter 4. And that wraps up kind of this section of the historical parts of the book of Daniel, because, you know, Nebuchadnezzar is gone pretty much from here out. So in the next couple chapters. So anyway, I appreciate you listening today. Check out BaptistBasics.org for other resources. Follow Baptist Basics on Facebook. You can find the link on BaptistBasics.org. You can leave a review on iTunes. I'd really appreciate that. And anyway, that's it. If you want to email me, podcast@BaptistBasics.org will get to me. And anyway, that'll do it. I'm Matthew Gage, and I appreciate you listening today.